Hello, this is Byron Richards, and you are tuned in to my weekly Wellness Update podcast, bringing you the health news that you can use. Well, we have some interesting studies for women, basically ages 50 and over, but it's a good lessons for everyone. So we'll get started here. Magnesium deficiency common in postmenopausal women. Now, this was a study with 171 healthy postmenopausal women, and it found them to be lacking in magnesium almost across the board. In fact, the longer it had been since their last menstrual cycle, the more likely they were to be or to have a greater magnesium deficiency. Now, why that is the case, I'm not entirely sure. I don't know that having a menstrual cycle boosts your magnesium status, but apparently not having one certainly trends with the depletion of this vital nutrient. Now, magnesium is a fundamental mineral to the health of everyone. It's used up by stress. You sweat it out if you exercise a lot. And, you know, we really don't get enough of it in our diets in the first place unless we go out of our way to be healthy with our veggies and whole grains and so on, almonds and whatnot that can be high in these nutrients, but or this nutrient magnesium. But my point here is that because magnesium controls several hundred enzymes that influence almost every aspect of a person's health, when we're looking at fundamental things that a person should be supplementing or ensuring they get enough of in their diet, magnesium has to be a top choice, especially as you get older. Because it is clear that it runs greater levels of deficiency. Now, we know that magnesium is vital to the cardiovascular health of women as they get older, vital to blood pressure regulation, and key brain nutrient for inflammation reduction, actually for inflammation reduction everywhere in your body. It's the key mineral that is involved with so much inflammation reduction-related activity. If you don't have magnesium adequately, it just doesn't function right. So this is a basic, very important for everyone, but especially as we grow older, not to run deficient in it. And of course, those who are more prone to anxiousness, trouble sleeping through the night, shorter stress fuse, these are some typical magnesium deficiency manifestations. So keep that in mind, please. Now, this one is melatonin may benefit metabolism and reduce cancer risk in postmenopausal women. We know that weight issues are invariably more difficult to manage for women than men, although, you know, it's somewhat debatable these days when we see both struggling with the issue. But estrogen, which is made in fat cells, women have a higher percentage of body fat naturally. That's basically so they can nourish young babies once they're born, but the point being they have more, and when you have more estrogen, you have more fat cells, you have more estrogen. So you make estrone in your fat cells. This can be converted to estradiol. This tends to it tends to reinforce the ease with which a person gains weight. Now, you would think that a hysterectomy then would eliminate that and maybe be good for weight loss, but no. The opposite happens to be the case. So when women have had a hysterectomy with their ovaries removed, interestingly, they have the same difficulty with weight gain and the onset of metabolic problems. So while the system is, if it's out of balance, a risk factor, if it's deficient, it's also a risk factor for weight gain. Now, there were some very interesting studies done with melatonin, and these are animal studies, but they relate. And in the first one, they gave the little rats an ovarectomy, and 14 days later started them on estrogen replacement therapy, and the other half of these were given melatonin. And in the group without melatonin, the estrogen they were taking caused abnormal endometrial proliferation, and mutated precancer cells then formed in this excessive growth tissue. And this, of course, is typical then of estrogen replacement therapy, but also of women who are, say, have too much estrogen. And the researchers concluded that melatonin supplementation may play an important role in the prophylaxis of endometrial cancer in menopause, meaning that those given melatonin did not get these proliferation and precancer cells. So melatonin had a huge difference. Now, I've previously reported that low melatonin is a risk for breast cancer in postmenopausal women. That was a human study, but this new study just adds more data showing that melatonin is highly protective to the female reproductive system. It's a very potent antioxidant, and it may be very important in the aging process, especially as you don't sleep as well. Now, you may only need a half a milligram of melatonin, but you may need more. In fact, you may need different amounts at different times of the year, where you might need a little bit more in the colder, shorter months as we're going through right now. Anyway, second study on the same topic. Again, we have overactimized rats, and some were given hormone replacement while others were given melatonin with no hormones. And then we had a control group. So the untreated animals gained weight, became insulin resistant, even had elevated cholesterol and triglycerides as a side effect of having their ovaries removed. All of these issues, all of them, were prevented by melatonin, far better than estrogen, meaning that if once the ovaries were removed, the most important thing to replace appears to be melatonin. And if doing so, the side effects of the loss of estrogenic function can be ameliorated so that they are not problematic. So the researchers said here that the present study provides strong evidence for melatonin supplementation therapy to be more potent and effective in comparison to estrogen replacement therapy due to its single-handed ability to revert all the ovarectomy-induced changes. No side effects with long-term melatonin, and obviously there are with cancer, which makes it a more attractive as a candidate to treat postmenopausal symptoms, melatonin. So here we have melatonin and magnesium, both important for women in the menopausal years, postmenopausal years. Aha, and our last study in this triad of postmenopausal studies is that DHEA improves postmenopausal symptoms and sex life. Now, this is a human study, and women were given low-dose DHEA, which is 10 milligrams per day, which I think is a very safe dose of DHEA, although I still prefer that women use the 7-keto form of DHEA, which is the safest form, but a low dose of any kind of DHEA is not going to be much of an issue, 10 milligrams being a low dose. By the time you get to 25 or 50, you're getting up there in the dosing, and you really should be only using 7-keto DHEA. Because the DHEA can potentially convert to estrogen, whereas the 7-keto does not. But anyway, in this study, we have to remember that DHEA is a primary hormone produced by your adrenal glands. You actually make more DHEA than cortisol, even though you hear more about cortisol because it's the stress hormone. But actually, the two have to be there in tandem with each other. When cortisol functions best when you have DHEA, when you don't have DHEA, which declines with age, then your cortisol is more likely to play into a perpetual stress response, locking in inflammation, stress, wear and tear. In other words, cortisol doesn't do its anti-inflammatory chores so well when your adrenal output is lacking DHEA. And it's at that point, of course, that you gain abdominal weight. Very common in the postmenopausal years because the struggle to balance hormones, female hormones sits on top of the adrenal glands, just gives them extra work to do. When the adrenals already had enough work to do, managing stress and getting through the day and all the demands that are on someone. So this is just one more demand called menopause added to all the other demands, which tends then to lower the DHEA levels. That, as I said, could lead to abdominal weight gain. But this study was especially focusing on the sex life of the women involved. And they found that the women who took the DHEA had fewer menopausal symptoms, hot flashes and that kind of thing, and they had improved sexual function and frequency of sexual intercourse, meaning they just had the idea that this would be a whole lot more fun now, and so were participating in that activity. So, not a bad idea. Some DHEA, some melatonin, some magnesium, all things that postmenopausal women should be considering, especially if feeling stressed out or not sleeping well, sex drive not there, abdominal weight gain. All of these things can help balance this set of symptomatology, which is so common, without the side effects, without the risks. You know, you just can't take estrogen replacement therapy and suppress your symptoms. It is dangerous. You know, if you have to do it, it's a short-term solution. Figure out how to solve the actual problems. All right, what else do we have here? Well, this was a feature-length study I did, selenium's vital role in thyroid hormone function. I think it's, of course, very important that everybody figure out how to get their thyroid hormone in tip-top working condition. There is no question that the mineral selenium is absolutely indispensable to the function of the thyroid gland and to the function of thyroid hormone in the human body. So as always, we want to review these things to make sure that you understand this and understand the importance of it. The highest concentration of selenium in the human body happens to be your liver, your kidneys, and your thyroid gland. So what's it doing in the thyroid gland, not to mention the liver and the kidneys? Well, within your thyroid gland, you have cells that must make thyroxine, or T4, which is your basic thyroid hormone. These cells are called thyrocytes. They are like carpenters that build thyroid hormone. Now, what is thyroid hormone? Thyroid hormone is one molecule of a tyrosine, that's an amino acid, and four molecules of iodine. And these things have to be connected together. And your thyrocytes, they produce a protein called thyroglobulin. And it is the thyroglobulin that then enables on the surface of the thyroglobulin, the process of connecting iodine and tyrosine together takes place. So this is a very energy intense activity. Obviously, you need iodine and tyrosine because those are the raw materials that make the actual hormone. But you've got these thyrocytes, and they are really pumping out the production here. They have to really crank up their use of energy. This is a very energy-intense, energy-demanding process, the production of thyroid hormone. And it is, as it turns out, it's metabolically expensive. And by that I mean it's not entirely efficient. But the trade-off for making all this hormone is, unfortunately, that free radicals are generated while this is going on. The actual free radical type that is produced is called hydrogen peroxide, which is H2O2. And so, in order for your thyroid gland to be healthy as it's making thyroid hormone, you must deactivate the H2O2 that is being produced naturally as you make and produce the hormone. This requires an enzyme called glutathione peroxidase. That's the one that mops up, like kind of like a sponge. It just soaks up and neutralizes the H2O2. And as it turns out, the single most important nutrient for the activation and function of glutathione peroxidase is selenium. This means that if you are lacking in selenium, then your thyroid gland is not able to mop up all the, or deactivate all the H2O2 it produces, at which point the H2O2 begins to inflame and injure the thyroid gland. So one of the functions of selenium, which is absolutely indispensable for human health, is to guard and protect the thyroid gland so that it can healthfully produce thyroid hormone in the first place. That in and of itself is reason enough for nobody to be deficient in selenium. But the role of selenium for thyroid hormone is far more involved than simply guarding the production of it within the thyroid gland. Once your thyroid gland makes thyroid hormone, which is T4, that is not biologically active. It has to be activated into something called T3. And basically what that means is that one molecule of iodine is stripped away from T4 So now instead of having four molecules of iodine and one of tyrosine, you have three molecules of iodine and one of tyrosine. That is biologically active thyroid hormone called T3. So this process, there has to be a process where this is done. So your body uses enzymes to lop off one of the iodine molecules, and these enzymes are called deiodinases. That means they're taking an iodine away. So that's what they are called. And you have three of them, basically. You have type 1, 2, and 3. They're called ID1, ID2, ID3. But you've got these enzymes. So ID1 converts T4 to T3, and this is what enables then your cells to respond to thyroid hormone. The T3 binds onto the outside of a cell membrane all over your body. It goes into the cell by what's called a second messenger. It attaches to the DNA of the cell and tells it how fast it should go as a basic metabolic pace. Thyroid is kind of like the drummer in the band. It's telling the cells how fast they can do things. It's setting the pace, you might say. It's not responsible for you getting up and running across the room at warp speed. That's adrenaline. It is the it's the idling speed of your car engine. But that idling speed must be sound, or you can't go from an idling speed to fast speeds. You know, funky things start to happen if you're pace isn't good. You step on the gas and you conk out, or you can only go so far for a very, very short period of time and then you conk out. In other words, you have to have this foundation of proper metabolic pacing, otherwise you can't do anything fast either. Now, obviously, when you're governing a metabolic pace, it's burning calories at a baseline, and that's going to give you a better overall calorie burning potential compared to idling too slow, and thus the profound effect of thyroid on body weight and metabolism and just about everything else, because realize that every cell in your body that's part of an organ system, so whether we're talking about the brain, the liver, the kidneys, the heart, the pancreas, or muscles, or connective tissue, it doesn't really matter. Whatever the cell is, it has to be responding to thyroid hormone. So thyroid hormone, when it's not working at the right pace, is potentially handicapping anything and everything in your body. Meaning the symptoms as a result of poor thyroid function can be almost infinite, although there are some common ones, like being too cold. Really, poor thyroid function can wreak havoc with just about anything. So you really want to get optimal T4 to T3 conversion. This takes place mostly on your liver, somewhat in your kidneys, somewhat in your muscles. So your ID1 enzyme activates this, and as it turns out, these enzymes, these deiodinase enzymes, all require selenoproteins to function, which means if you don't have enough selenium, these enzymes that regulate thyroid hormone don't work right. Period. You must have adequate selenium for them, for T4 to be converted to T3. You also, there's the ID2 enzyme, is what activates thyroid hormone in your brain. So your brain has a different activation system for thyroid hormone, and that's primarily a genetic survival feature, meaning that if your body has to turn down your metabolic rate because you're starving, the brain cannot be turned down too far, or you wouldn't be awake enough to notice that there was food around that you should hunt and gather so you can eat. So your brain has a different system for regulating thyroid hormone, which tends to keep you more awake even when the rest of your body has to be hibernating. And so this is under the influence of a different deiodinase enzyme, which works cell by cell in your brain, and that's called the type 2 enzyme, ID2. And then you have ID3, which either converts, it's kind of like the brakes on the system. So you're not always wanting go signals. Sometimes you want stop signals, where you convert T4 into reverse T3, which is the brake T3, or active T3 into the inactive T2. So you have a way of stopping the system or regulating it. Anyway, all of these enzymes that control this activity all require selenium. And if you don't have enough selenium, your thyroid hormone regulation is handicapped. Why would you want to do that? Makes no sense whatsoever. So we can see right away that the preservation of thyroid hormone is the utmost importance of survival. And selenium, once you start running low on it, your body's got tough choices. It'll keep the ID2 system, it'll try to keep it going in your brain as long as possible. But your thyroid function, can decrease by up to 99% in your liver and kidneys, meaning T4 to T3 conversion, liver, kidneys, muscles can be significantly handicapped, while the thyroid gland in the brain might drop by 50%. So your selenium, it tries when a deficiency to keep the thyroid and the brain working as last ditch efforts and will give up the function of the kidneys, liver and muscles, activating hormone. It's kind of like who gets less when there's less around. It's like, where are you going to dole out the selenium? So, you know, this is a survival strategy for starvation, but, you know, why do we need to be low in selenium? When we get low in selenium, you start to develop autoimmune thyroiditis, Hashimoto's, because the inflammatory damage combined with the sluggish function creates the gland getting inflamed. We found here in a 2010 study that selenium supplementation helped to reduce the elevated thyroid autoantibodies, which is, of course, very good news for everybody. And I go on in this article to review all of the controversy around the dose of selenium needed, and it's somewhere between 200 and 300 micrograms per day is probably best for optimizing immune function, and that dose, maybe even up to 600 micrograms a day for some people, would be ideal for optimizing thyroid hormone function. But the problem here is that, you know, you get a lot of selenium in the soil generally, meaning that it's in the soil, it gets into the food. So if you eat a wide variety of fresh foods and vegetables and so on, you would get your selenium, but it's just not in the soil when the soil isn't cared for. And so we have massive selenium deficiency leading to stressed thyroid function, leading to just about all kinds of health problems, reducing the quality of health across the board, not just metabolism, but, thyroid problems have a domino effect on every other system in the human body because thyroid is governing the pace of cellular activity of every organ system function in your body. So this is big. It's huge. It's incredibly important, and it's a society-wide deficiency. It is something we must correct if we're going to contribute to solving the obesity epidemic. But even if you're not overweight, you can be having these problems. You don't have to, you know, just overweight is not the only sign of a thyroid problem. But my point here is selenium is so important that you just don't want to be lacking this mineral for healthy thyroid hormone function. Period. All right. We're going to go now to your questions this week. The first one comes from Giselle, who says, recent tests show a parathyroid hormone of 70, which for those of you who may not know, that's a little bit elevated. The blood test showed calcium at 9.5, which, again, that's in the middle of normal range. But the doctor put me on some bisphosphonate treatment. Oh, the evil bisphosphonate drugs. One pill weekly. So you got the one a week, you got the, Boniva, or that's the one a month. Well, whatever. The one a week you got. Okay, fine. You went back after 3 months and the parathyroid hormone went up to 132. I guess that wasn't very successful, was it? I am very athletic, healthy, active person who just happens to have osteopenia. Would lactoferrin help at all? Thank you. All right, Giselle. Now, first of all, understand that, your PTH of 70 and then darting up to 132. Well, the reason it went up to 132 is because of the bisphosphonates shocking your bones. And that's all that happened. In other words, you already had a parathyroid problem. And when the number's high, that means your parathyroid is a little bit hyperactive. That may not be a clinical condition, but it's trending in that direction. And your calcium's still normal, so, you know, we don't know yet. But we do see that as a weak spot in your system. And then, of course, When it jets up to 132, that meant the repercussion, the domino effect coming from poisoning your bones with bisphosphonates, jolted an already weak spot and caused your parathyroids to go, "What the heck are you doing to me?" Of course, they do that a lot under the influence of the medical profession, but this happened to be what we're talking about here. So, you know, I mean, it is true enough that a lot of people with hyperparathyroid might have a benign tumor growth on their parathyroid that requires surgery to remove it. But before you jump into that, understand that there is a synergy of function between your parathyroids and your bones. So what you're trying to do naturally and nutritionally is smooth it out. You're trying to smooth out the communication and the relationship. So the first most important nutrient, of course, is vitamin D. And if you have any kind of an elevated parathyroid, you want to get your vitamin D score to 3/4 of the way up the normal range. It's not good enough to be in the 30s or even in the 40s if you've got your parathyroid doing a little funky stuff on you. You've got to get that that vitamin D score up between 50 and 80. And closer to 80 would probably be a better idea. That's the first thing you want to straighten out. Then you want a comprehensive array of bone support, anti-inflammatory bone support nutrition. So things that are in like the bone and joint helper, things that are like extra DHA, extra quercetin. You want anti-inflammatories for bones, tocotrienols. And you want to use these nutrients to calm the inflammation in the bone. Then you want to be on a good calcium product that is easy to use calcium for your bones, such as Daily Bone Excel, as an example. And that's what the program you work, Giselle. And then you see how you do with that. You watch it, you tweak it, and so on and so forth. All right, Jenna says, thanks for your amazing podcast. Well, you're welcome, Jenna. Let's see. She says, I've always had a poor appetite. Specifically, I have always hated eating any type of meat. The taste, smell, the texture completely grosses me out. Same with eggs, unfortunately. I'm sure it's partially psychological, but I really can't help it. Therefore, pretty much all the protein in my diet is dairy-based, mostly organic. I consume a lot of your whey powder and also eat almond nut butter. Can I get away with relying on dairy and nuts and whey protein for a long term? I can't stand the thought of having to regularly eat meat for the rest of my life. I'm 22. I don't eat any junk or sugar. Many thanks. Well, Jenny, yes, you're getting enough variety. Of course, the dairy proteins, especially the whey protein, are complete proteins. So they do fill your nourishment. Of course, you get some good proteins in legumes, which you can add in. And nuts and a variety of nuts are a great way to also get protein. So there's no reason you should be deficient. Now, you may lack some of the cofactor nutrients like iron, and you may need to take an iron supplement such as our blood booster. That would help you to not lack that important nutrient for your health. This would especially be the case if you have heavier menstrual cycles, but you're not really getting a lot of iron what you're eating. So that would be something to pay attention to. But beyond that, I don't see the problem here. Jenna, you can just make up for it just fine. You don't have to eat meat, especially if you don't want to. Jane says, hi, thanks for all your great articles. I've noticed that on the most well-known health sites, what too much alcohol does to your system is avoided. Well, Jane, that's because we all like to drink a lot. Just kidding, Jane. Really, I'm just kidding. Why is this? I have a friend who is very health conscious, who lives and breathes by your site, but drinks too much. This is nuts and needs to be addressed. I hope you will devote a long article to it and draw much attention to it. Well, Jane, I hope your friend listens to my website, because I have such a backlog of writing that I'm working on. I'm now simultaneously working on 4 books. Good Lord. And they're going to come out. So hold your breath. Anyway, But so I can't write long articles as I might like to, especially, alcohol is a very interesting topic. Alcohol in small amounts is probably good for most people or some people, not everyone. It's not like you have to drink alcohol to be healthy. But, you know, we take the French paradox as an example, and here they have red wine with their relatively high-fat foods, and they don't have heart disease. Seemingly doesn't add up, but you got to understand that alcohol is a fat solvent. So it tends to help keep the fats in your diet in solution so your body can better utilize them and they don't get so stuck in the bloodstream. So in small doses, especially red wine, alcohol is of minimal impact to your health. Now, what happens when you exceed that relatively modest dose of alcohol? Well, what is now a fat solvent becomes a fat destroyer. And it starts to destroy the parts of your body that are supposed to be made of healthy fat, which would be, in particular, your liver and your brain. So as soon as you exceed a certain dose of alcohol that's relevant to, you know, and it's going to vary from person to person, but now you've got an issue where the alcohol dose is up, and you're going to knock your system down. So alcohol damages the liver, damages the brain, and as your male friend should know, Jane, it damages testosterone transport systems rather dramatically. So high alcohol intake tends to wipe out manliness as time goes along, which is never a good thing for any guy, especially as we get older. So those are the main reasons you would not want to drink too much. And for those curious, of course, you can go to my website and, I do write a few articles, but I hate to confess, they are about how to get around the problem. So, for example, if you take Silymarin and Panathene and magnesium and zinc, before you drink too much, you're much less likely to have any adverse side effects from it. And I know that's not what you wanted to hear, Jane. But nevertheless, alcohol intake in excess every now and then is unfortunately fairly common. And so it's probably a good idea to understand that. But I do agree with you. Regular intake of too much alcohol is a very bad thing for human health. It should not be done. It is not a healthy pattern of living. It is having fun at the expense of long-term health. You cannot take enough vitamins to offset the damage you would do from this type of behavior. And so I think it all needs to be kept in perspective. All right. Yasmin, writing in from the UK, says, I am 34 years old and have just discovered your site and found it very interesting, so I was hoping you could help me by advising me the right products to use. I'm on thyroxine medication at the moment, and I have heart palpitations that really scare me that are related to this condition. So please, can you help? And also have problems trying to lose weight. I hope you can help me. Thanks. Well, now you didn't mention, Yasmin, if your heart palpitations are due to the thyroxine you're taking, or if you had them prior to taking thyroxine, or if you had them prior and now they're worse. And the reason I bring that up is because, you know, thyroid medication is hardly ever the solution. Now, yes, you can be clinically out of range, but you really want to work on finding the lowest dose of medication you need and then getting off of it one day because you don't need it, not because you're ignoring a problem. The heart palpitations, if you're not on thyroid medication and are related to the poor thyroid, that's because your thyroid function is controlling the rate of oxygen use in your cells. And when your thyroid is going sluggish, then your heart starts to freak out and has to move oxygen faster because your thyroid's going slower. That can make your heart race trying to get oxygen to cells as a secondary backup system to the inability of cells to use oxygen because of low thyroid. Maybe that's confusing, but that's what happens. Now, when you do take thyroid medication, you can also get a racy heart because the thyroid can be inappropriate, actually, even though, you know, when you take thyroid medication, it's never in sync with your body's metabolism, ever. It's forcing this large dose of stimulant into your body at a given time of the day, and then your body's supposed to see what it does with it. And So sometimes what happens is it ramps up your nervous system activity metabolically and gives you heart palpitations. So that's a different reason for getting them. So in the first case, yes, you want to correct the thyroid. Well, actually, in both cases, you want to activate thyroid hormone better, which is why you want, say, a product like Thyroid Helper. Now, the only caution with Thyroid Helper and thyroid medication is that if you are feeling jittery when you're taking Thyroid Helper, that usually means your thyroid hormone is working better, whether it's your own hormone or your medication. And you may need less medication. You have to work with your doctor, of course, but realize that because the Thyroid Helper can make the hormone behave more efficiently, you may not need as much of it, which is always a good thing. Heart palpitations, the most common reason for them is a lack of magnesium, which I would then boost up on in conjunction with any kind of thyroid, regardless of the reason, I would use that. And then I would work with nutrients that enhance oxygen utilization, such as Cardio Helper, Coenzyme Q10. These would be key nutrients that could be used along with Thyroid Helper to help oxygenate your heart properly, to help have your heart, help your heart function better. Cardio Helper, for example, is a heart tonic. Has the hawthorn berry in it, the horse chestnut. I mean, very, very helpful. CoQ10 is a major nutrient for restoring cardiovascular vitality and energy function of the heart muscle itself. So you can do things that help how your heart utilizes oxygen even in the presence of a sluggish thyroid. Of course, your basic thyroid supplements are Thyroid Helper, Daily Energy Multi, and some ISL iodine. Retta writes in, happy to write to you. You make me more interested to study clinical nutrition. Well, that's nice to hear. I ordered some products which may help me and my wife, Nadira. Thank you. I'm 36-year-old man from Singapore. 4 years ago, I got a deep vein thrombosis. Now, I think it's calcified, thus not as dangerous, but my left leg is all swollen. Please, do you know a supplement, an enzyme that can dissolve the fibrin of the DVT, or the deep vein thrombosis? I saw a cure based on leech therapy. It's very interesting. Well, I don't know anything about leech therapy, Retta. So, I know it's been used in medicine on and off, actually, for a long time. But I don't practice with it, so I couldn't tell you how to use it or endorse it. Not saying it may not be a value for some people. It's just beyond my scope of practice, you might say. So dissolving fibrin. Yes, you want enzymes. The best one is bromelain. We use full-strength bromelain in our Repair Plus. Of course, bromelain's in pineapples. You're in Singapore, so maybe you can get a lot of pineapples and just eat them all the time. Not a bad idea. You want a lot of fish oil, so you get your deep sea fatty fish. Again, you probably have good access to that. But we use our DHA products. But the fatty fish will go into the area where the clot was and help to make it more stable, so it won't break apart abnormally as you're dissolving it. And I love the tocotrienol form of vitamin E, which over there in Singapore you can probably find in palm oil as part of your diet. Or you can take some tocotrienol supplements, which I also would recommend. Actually, I prefer. I like the Daily Super E, which comes from rice bran oil, so it's not as high in saturated fat as the palm oil. But you're not going to have a problem with palm oil as long as you don't eat it in excess. But you know, tocotrienols, bromelain is the best enzyme in general for dissolving fibrin, and we'll eat these things up, gobble them up as time goes along, and then you want to make sure you have adequate fish oils. This way, and you could do something like Cardio Helper as well with the grapeseed extracts and so on that help to nourish the vascular wall, so it's more stable as well. So you can be very comprehensive about it if you want, but that's the strategy I would use to work away at that issue. Andrew says, I am 47, have a good diet, I've always been an athlete, I run 12 to 15 miles per week and lift weights. Good for you, Andrew. Even though I am in good shape, I can still pinch about 1.5 to 2 inches of belly fat and can't seem to get rid of it. How can I get rid of this belly fat and lower my overall body fat? Ah, yes, the inefficiency of the aging process. You want to boost testosterone a little bit, male plus would be a good idea. You could do up to six a day. I would then, stubborn fat, the last 5 pounds or so, it's either toxic or it's stress numb. So you either have to relax more to lose the weight, anti-inflammatories like Repair Plus, for example, Bone and Joint Helper, Jointol, and higher doses will reduce the inflammation in the fat. Quercetin, tocotrienols, that might work. Otherwise, you got to get the last remnant toxins out of that fat, which would be high-dose chlorella, up to 12 a day. I've seen that work for guys. We're talking about the last few pounds. So it's either stress-numbed fat or toxic fat. That's the bottom line. Okay, Mary says, I am trying to figure out how to tighten up my stomach. I have always had a tight, hard stomach until 43 years old. I am now 49, 5'5", and weigh 130 pounds. I teach Zumba twice a week, exercise three other times a week, an hour of cardio, and 10 minutes on the total gym. I had a hysterectomy a year ago, and I'm now on estradiol. I can't figure out why my stomach has a layer of fat. I don't overeat. I maintain the same weight, but my stomach is soft. Will your vitamin packets help this? Well, Mary, the vitamin packets probably will help that in general because they help multiple aspects of your metabolism. However, as long as you are on estradiol, you are unlikely to succeed at losing any stomach fat because estradiol promotes its to be there. So the fact that you don't have more is probably a good thing, and the only reason you don't is because of all the good things you do for yourself. As I mentioned earlier, melatonin is a better use, and Female Plus, which would be my top choice, also has the 7-keto DHEA, which helps with belly fat. And then I would use our Profem cream, which has progesterone and estriol, not estradiol. Now, you may or may not get hot flashes, but you got to get through that. The estradiol is simply drugging your brain into thinking the ovaries that you don't have made it. The hormone you actually need from here on out is estriol, which they're not even giving you. And without that, you can't uninflame. So you want to figure out how to get off the estradiol. Usually with your doctor, you can wean off of it. But you know, to avoid a shock of symptoms, because you did have your ovaries taken out. At this age, it's fine to go through menopause, and you're going to have to balance your estrogen. So besides what I just said, other nutrients that either help reduce inflammation or boost stress management are where you're going to get the benefit. But once the ovaries are gone, it is very, very difficult to not have abdominal belly fat. You might be able to do it because of your inherent baseline of fitness, Mary, so I wouldn't give up on it. But I'll tell you, estradiol supplementation makes it impossible, in my opinion. And you may be able to prove me wrong, but I've never seen it. Karen says, I read about the possible risk of stroke, but what supplement is good to prevent this? It was not mentioned. My mother had a hemorrhagic stroke 10 years ago. She experiences dizziness and is very fatigued. That's probably because of all the medications they have her on, Mary, or Karen, excuse me. Could a multiple vitamin help that, which has B12, folic acid, B6, as well as the supplement for strokes? Thank you. A hemorrhage stroke is different from a clot forming. That's where, vascular breakage occurs. And the best nutrient for protecting against a hemorrhagic stroke is both the number one thing would be grapeseed extract, in my opinion. So I like the Cardio Helper to support the integrity of the lining of the veins and blood vessels in the brain. That would be the best choice there. Of course, those people who are on medical blood thinners are at risk for one of those. So that's that as it may. B12, folic acid, B6, like the Daily Energy Multi, would reduce homocysteine, which is a major irritant to the vascular system, so that would help keep the vascular system cleaner of irritation, which then, of course, means there's less risk for clots forming. So a good basic multi is always the basic thing, and then you go to your basic antioxidants. I of course, like the Daily Super E. That would be my first choice of a supplement. Repair Plus with bromelain and curcumin help keep the circulation clean while reducing inflammation, as this product like Cardio Helper. So you can be very comprehensive here. No guarantee, of course, that anyone wouldn't get a stroke. But I mean, your goal here, in terms of, instead of talking about this as a disease like a stroke, We want to talk about the protection of the nervous system and the vascular system with antioxidants. There's many, many, many nutrients that can help. You've got your DHA. You've got the vitamin E, tocotrienols. You've got all kinds of flavonoids and things. There are many, many things you can do to be in a healthier trend. But you got to remember, it's not just vitamins. It's your lifestyle. You know, when you look at these numbers, you know, people got cholesterol numbers and triglyceride numbers and inflammation numbers and so on. You know, the numbers aren't anywhere near as important as what you're doing overall with your health, Karen. So if you're tired, if you're fatigued, if you're in a trend of wear and tear, you're at risk. I don't care what your numbers are, even if they're good. You're at risk. If you're older, you're at risk. And the better, the more fit you feel exercising, the more consistently you do the exercise, the more you say, I'm in a trend where I feel more energy, I feel less wear and tear, the less risk you have. I don't care what your numbers are. You're moving in the right direction. So a lot of it is just about how you manage your overall life. It's a lot of factors. It's your lifestyle. It's how well you sleep. It's how well you eat. It's the nutrients can be extremely helpful. But you plug all these in into an overall system of where's your stress bank book balancing, Karen, and your wear and tear bank book. And that really is the telling thing that you need to know for cardiovascular well-being. And that tells you in a nutshell your risk factors and not your risk factors. And quite frankly, it's that little subjective feeling as a trend over time is far more telling than anything else, lab test wise. All right, that's it for your questions this week. Thanks for rating me. I'll be back next week with another weekly wellness update podcast. And of course, if you have questions, please email me questions. AskByron@wellnessresources.com. Take care.
The Weekly Wellness Update Podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated. Copyright 2008. All rights reserved. For more information on the topics and news covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.